Okay, good evening, everyone. I think we'll make a start in Vinner style. We always start, try to start on time. Welcome, everyone, to what I think is going to be a very, very important and insightful session. We are around the concept of parenting, of course. We are very, very honored tonight to have a very special guest who's, I was going to say, all the way from America, but actually currently in Eretz Yisrael. Dr. Sarah Yaroslawitz, I hope I can pronounce that correctly, who is a very, very experienced and noted expert on many areas of parenting. Dr. Yaroslawitz created and authored the Handsful program, which gives a unique behavior management protocol for parents, teachers, schools, principals, and so on and so forth. She has a clinic in New York and is published and very, very busy and been involved in parenting for many, many years. So I want to give everyone a bit of context. So a while ago, there's a podcast, which I know some of you listen to, called Headlines by David Lichtenstein. And I often listen to it. In fact, this time my wife listened to it first. And she came and told me, you have to hear this. You'll love this, Dr. Yaroslawitz, what she has to say about parenting. So of course I did. And it just really resonated. It's Torah-based. It's important stuff in today's world, where the concept of authority, the concept of the boundaries, the concept of all these things connected to it is so scarce and so rare. It's a really amazing approach, and I think you're going to find it amazingly interesting and relevant. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask Dr. Yaroslawitz some questions. If anyone has questions, please put them in the chat or private message me on the chat, and hopefully towards the end we'll have some time for some questions. So, Dr. Yaroslawitz, I think you need to unmute yourself.
Okay.
Hi. Hi, and welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, as I said, I heard you talk on the podcast a while ago, and I heard you begin with talking about some of the goals that you define as the goals of parenting. And you also talked about something that we have 7,000 days to make this happen. So could you elaborate on that just as an introduction? What are the goals and why the 7,000 days?
Okay, so the 7,000 days is really just a ballpark figure for approximately 20 years. If you do the math, that's about what it takes. A child and every human being is on this world for 120 years. And basically only 20 out of those 120 do they spend with us, if you think about it. So that's a sixth. So we don't get a lot of time. 7,000 days seems like a lot, but it's really a little. And anybody who's married off children already knows that it goes like that. So you get that, that's the amount of years you get to get the goals taught, to get the job done, to produce the product. So when you go from the hospital nursery to the chuppah, that's the time that you need to prepare your child for adulthood. So the goals of adulthood, what are the goals of adulthood? What is it that we want once we take our child to the chuppah? So there are three things. Number one, that the child should be what we call shomer Torah mitzvahs, that they should follow the Torah and all of its mitzvos. Number two, they should be emotionally stable, ready to form healthy relationships with spouses and children. And the third thing, and that's just a passing joke, is that they should still be talking to you. Those are the three goals. They should be shomer Torah mitzvos, they should be able to be emotionally stable and form healthy relationships, and they should be talking to you. Now, there are three major skills that need to be taught in order for those goals to happen. Do you want me to go through those skills?
Okay, so just before you do, so I just want to sort of give a bit of introduction to that. So you mentioned on the podcast when I was listening to you, and I subsequently read some of the stuff, and I found your podcast as well. I've discovered it. So, I mean, I want to sort of make this context very clear to everyone. Obviously, parents love their children. I know you mentioned that on the thing that I heard. And I'm assuming that it's important for them to express that love and to have a good, warm relationship with their children. So we take that as a given. And I suppose what we're going to talk about in terms of, you know, the various stages of obedience and so on work better when there's a healthy household and it's a functional household and it's a loving household and so on. So I don't want anyone to get the impression that that's not important, but I'm sure that's a given, that is important. But you spoke about, I'm sorry?
Right. Yeah, sorry. Those are givens. And if you look at the write-ups on my program, the program is designed for the normally developing child and the normally developing household. In other words, this is a health and wellness model. This model of parenting is defined for the basic. Now, normal, healthy household, yes, there'll be some raised voices from time to time. And yes, it'll get chaotic. And yes, it'll, no one's saying it's got to be a museum and it's got to be perfect. But the overall warmth and health in the atmosphere has to be prevalent.
Okay, so if that's there, hopefully, you talked about, in terms of behavior management, you talked about three stages: frustration tolerance, obedience, and impulse control. So let's go through them one by one. I'll veer off with some questions on the side, but let's sort of try and, let's start with the first one, the frustration tolerance. Does it have to come first? Is it age specific? How does it work?
Right, so just to be very, very clear, those three phases, frustration tolerance, obedience, and impulse control, frustration tolerance plus obedience plus impulse control ultimately will yield those three goals that I previously mentioned. That I just want to make sure that that's clear. Frustration tolerance, yes. There's three times in the life cycle that the human being naturally becomes more agitated and frustrated. The Rebbeinu Shlom set that up. Hashem set that up. And those are the times of transition. There are three times. The first time they all have names. The first time is the terrible twos. That's when a child is transitioning from infant to child. Then a couple of years later comes adolescence. And that's when a child is transitioning from child to adult. And then, and it's not nogea now, it's not relevant now, comes midlife crisis, is when adults transition to geriatrics. Those are the three times in the life cycle that people tend to become more agitated. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is if the person is faced with a tendency to become more agitated, that means the control that they exercise to control themselves is self-teaching. They grow from it. We call this avaidas hamidas, working on one's midas, working on one's character traits. So Hashem set up the terrible twos. It's very early in the life cycle. It's approximately from 18 months till about 3.5 or 4. And that period of time is when a child learns to tolerate frustration. You can't tolerate something unless you experience it, right? If somebody says, I have a high tolerance to pain, or I have a high tolerance to heat, they wouldn't know unless they experience pain or heat, right? So a person can't develop frustration tolerance unless they're exposed to frustration. And Hashem sets that up, that the two-year-old is automatically frustrated. Isn't that interesting? The two-year-old is automatically frustrated, and through that automatic setup, the child learns to tolerate what they're experiencing and what they're exposed to.
So practically, what does that look like? And how do we, I mean, I know that's now you can't go through the whole course, that's obvious, but if you can give us some practical things, what does it mean to train a child in frustration tolerance?
Well, the child will tantrum. A tantrum is a behavioral indication of frustration. Tantrums have many different faces. And the typical two-year-old, it's usually crying, screaming, kicking, throwing themselves on the floor. That's the typical, but there are others. I'm not going to go into them. They're more in the program. And the way a child learns to tolerate that frustration is if nobody tries to fix it for them. Nobody tries to work it out for them. They just left alone for a few moments to internally figure it out themselves. So how does that manifest? We use the word ignore in English. I don't like the word ignore. I never did. It has a negative connotation to it, but it's the only word in the English language that means remain unfazed. If I really had to define it better, remain unfazed. In other words, don't start tantruming with your child. Don't get frustrated with your child. Remain unfazed. In Chovos HaLevavos, there's a midah called hishtavos, right? And hishtavos means where we just stay unfazed. That's the best English word I can think of to translate it. just, it's not happening. You don't hear it, you don't see it. And this way it leaves the child in a little bit of a capsule, and the child will self-calm quicker than you can imagine. That's the best time in life to teach it.
Okay, so if you're in the supermarket and the child wants to schlep something off a shelf, and you take it away because they're not supposed to do it, and the child starts a tantrum.
Right, so you have two choices. You either can be so well-developed that you say to yourself, I'm okay, so my child's making a little bit of noise. Nobody's going to arrest me. No one's going to throw me out. I'm okay. And you keep wheeling that carriage down the aisles as if the child is not crying. That's a stage. That's a development. Some people can't handle that. They get very nervous. Okay, so if you get that nervous that you can't cope, so you abandon your shopping trip, you scoop up the child and you walk out of the store. Mouth shut. Sorry about my French. Don't talk. And just calm and just go into your car or bus or train or wherever you're going and go home. And yes, you will have missed out on a shopping trip, but the world will continue rotating on its axis. It's okay.
And if you keep repeating that, will a child learn not to tantrum? Or?
Exactly. See, there's two things that happens. Number one, the tantrums will get less in duration. They will last less. They will become less in frequency, and they will become less in intensity. Those are the three ways we measure tantrums: frequency, duration, and intensity. But besides the fact that the child will see that no attention is given to the tantrum, and all behaviors are like your teeth. If you ignore them, they go away. So behaviors die of neglect, so that it will get less. But besides that, the child will spontaneously outgrow that stage because that's how Hashem set it up. But they will outgrow that stage with this very, very special skill called frustration tolerance, which is the vehicle through which we go to the next stage.
So before we get to the next stage, just two points. I'm assuming that frustration tolerance is something that needs to be learned because we all have frustration, I suppose, along the journey of life.
Exactly. In other words, we don't want to lie to a child and deliver a world to them or an impression of a world that doesn't exist. This is Olam Hazeh. This is the world down here. And life doesn't always deliver what we want, when we want it, and how we want it. It just doesn't. I don't know about you, but it certainly doesn't deliver that to me. And imagine if we're all going to be on this planet 120 years. Imagine if, mathematically speaking, 50% of the time things went the way you want, and 50% of the time they didn't, let's say. And you could only be okay if things went the way you want. You could only be okay. That means you'd only be okay half your life. I think that's a terrible shame. But if you could be okay even when things don't go exactly the way you want, then you can be okay the whole 120 years. You could be healthy and okay and happy the whole 20 years. Happiness doesn't come from getting what you want. Happiness comes from making the best with what you have. We know this, Chazal tell it to us.
Okay, so before we go on to the next stage, which is obedience. So this is a stage that needs to come before we can train people for obedience, right?
Right.
And it's around the terrible twos, right? That's the age, more or less.
That's the optimal time. I'm going to be honest with you. Most people today, especially today, miss the boat of the terrible twos.
Because okay, it's my question. So now someone's on the Zoom, and they've got a child who's six, and they didn't do this.
They didn't do this. Nothing lost. It's okay. It's okay. It's not over. The Ribono Shel Olam gives you 7,000 days. It's a long time.
So how do you do it when the child's seven?
So when the child's seven, the tantrums are a bit different. I'm sorry?
I said the tantrums at seven are a bit different to two.
They're full of language. They get accompanied by chutzpah. They're longer. They could be more frequently, but not necessarily. And the intensity is greater. So that means I have to make the parent stronger. The parent has to understand, okay, I missed boat number one. I'm certainly not going to miss boat number two. Boat number two is adolescence, which ranges from age 9, 10-ish, all the way until 18. So if I miss boat number two, then it's an issue. So I'm going to work on this now. And instead of it taking 6 days, which is about what it takes with a toddler, really short, until they learn that mommy's not going to respond and change her mind just because I'm screaming. It's so fast with little ones. It's going to take 6 weeks, or it's going to take 8 weeks. It takes a while. So the parent has to be stronger.
Okay, so we go on to the stage of obedience. So before we get there, if you could just elaborate a bit before you talk about the tools of, and I know you have two stages of obedience, but before you talk about, you just maybe spend a moment explaining, because maybe we shouldn't have to explain this, but I think in this world, in today's world, maybe we do have to explain it. Why is it so important? I think particularly in a religious context, in a Jewish context, why is obedience so important?
Okay, so the way Yiddishkeit, Judaism, is structured, and the way the world was originally structured, there's a person is safe and secure when there's a framework. The framework is what creates the safety and security for a person to operate. And this framework involves being told what to do. I once had an amazing conversation with somebody who came back to Judaism, and I want to share it with you. We had them over for a Shabbos meal. And this was somebody who had been on Broadway and she had had it all. And she came all the way back to Yiddishkeit. And I said to her, come on, you got to explain this to me. With everything that you had, to give it all up for this, you know, I get it, but explain it to me. She said, you know what the moment was for her? And this, this is the last thing you're going to expect. She said, when I learned that there are certain days that you're not allowed to cut your fingernails and toenails, and that when you cut your fingernails, you've got to do 1, 3, 5, 2, 4. She says, that's when I knew this religion is safe. She says, because if I don't have to worry my head about making all of these silly decisions, then I'm free to grow. That's what she said. And I'll never forget it. It was such a beautiful, beautiful way of analyzing why freedom, you know, there's a chazal that says, Ein lecha ben chorin, ela misha osek b'torah b'mitzvahs. You don't have a free man, except the one that keeps the Torah and the mitzvahs. So the same thing could be applied. You don't have a free mother or a free child unless that person knows their code and the way they're going to follow it. And once they have that safety net, then they can grow to become anything they want to become. So that's why obedience is so important. And that's why the Torah is structured this way, 613 times, right? So that's the answer to that question. Go
ahead. So it's fair to say, therefore, that a child trained well in obedience to parents, I guess, you know, the old-fashioned mitzvah, kibbut avaim, will lead or help and facilitate them their respect for authority, teachers, Rosh Hashivas, and ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ultimately to be...
That's right. Rabban Shalom. Right. That's why Hashem made us with parents to begin with. I mean, why didn't Hashem make us like the goldfish? He needs us to diaper his babies. He could have figured it out himself. Why did he set it up with such a structure? Mother, father, children. Why? Because through the first 10-ish, 11-ish years of life, let's say, a child learns something we call Kabbalas Ol, accepting of authority, and that launches into Kabbalas Ol Machlo Shemayim, accepting the authority of the kingdom in heaven. So if a young child can't really understand Hashem is too abstract in the beginning. So the way they learn this relationship that we ultimately are going to have with Hashem, they learn it through their mothers and fathers.
Okay, that sounds great. So when I heard you talk, and you spoke about it briefly then, and now we have a bit more time so we can elaborate, I think. You talked about two stages of obedience. One was a technique called hand-to-hand, the other one was called nothing until.
Correct. Now, before I launch into that, I want to mention one other prat, is that during the first stage, we assume any child who can't tolerate frustration also can't obey. Okay, if my mother tells me to take a shower and I don't want to take a shower, and I'm a foreigner to frustration tolerance, I don't know how to be uncomfortable, I ain't taking no shower. Correct? Okay. So we assume that any child that's in the frustration tolerance stage can't obey. Now, if we were to tell such a child what to do and they are not capable of obeying, we are being iver on lifnei iver lo sitei michshol. Do not put a stumbling block before a blind. In other words, you're taking a child who cannot do something specific and you're creating another scenario of disobedience, another scenario of disobedience, another scenario of disobedience, which in turn would drive the child into disobedience. So because of that, I don't know if you saw this in the program, because of that, during phase one, I don't allow commands at all. I don't ever want it to be that a parent says a command and a child doesn't obey. So what do we do instead? After all, you do have to get the kid in and out of bathtubs, on and off school buses. Homework has to be done. Life has to happen. Coats have to be hung up. How do you do that? So there's a way. And that way is called mission statements. Do you remember this? A mission statement is, instead of saying to a child, the shoes belong, put your shoes in the closet, you would say the shoes belong in the closet, or the coat belongs on the hook, or the bus is coming, or the bed has to be made, or the playroom needs to be cleaned. So what happens? You say the shoes belong in the closet, and the child doesn't put the shoes in the closet because they're not obeyers yet. Nothing bad happened from a chinuch perspective. Why not? Because you never told them to. So the purpose of phase one is not only to teach frustration tolerance, but also to distance the child from disobedience, so that when we have to go to phase two and teach obedience, it's that much easier. Does that make sense?
Yeah, 100%. That's very, that's great.
Okay, so now to answer your question.
So moving on to obedience, you have to sort of feel comfortable that you've achieved the frustration tolerance.
Correct.
Okay, so now moving on to obedience.
So there are two strategies. One is for younger children and one is for older children.
Ideally, what age does this begin, obedience?
Obedience, as soon as a child has enough language to understand what you're asking him to do, which is approximately what, 18 months, 20 months, 22 months? So you would practice, and it's the cutest thing to see it on little ones. You'd give them a tissue and you would say, Baldy, throw this in the garbage, please. And then if the child doesn't throw it in the garbage, you would do something very simple called hand over hand, which means you take the child's hand. We have illustrations of this in the book and on the PDFs of the, you know, the CD. Take the child's hand on the tissue, your hand, you throw it in the garbage together and you say, thank you. And that's it. And that conditions the brain that when mommy says a command, it happens. And on young children, it works like that.
Okay, and the child that's like 3 or 4 and you say, let's go take a shower or let's go take a bath, and they say no.
That's right, so you walk them to the shower and you shower them. Calmly, no discussions, no bribes, no threats, no advertising of your weakness, of your panic, just relax, the child will relax with you. And this goes up until, now this depends on the height and the weight of a child, I have illustrations in the book, up until a child can be manipulated. And some kids are smaller and wirier and less mature than others, so we have to make sure that we get that right. At some point when a parent feels I can't move the child anymore, child got too big, too heavy, too mature, then we move to something called nothing until.
So before we do that, the hand-to-hand, is that designed specifically to speak less?
The idea is you don't want to repeat the command. Why not? Because if you repeat the command, the message that the child gets is, you didn't have to listen to me last time because she's going to repeat it again. So you don't have to listen to it this time because she'll say it again anyway. You don't have to listen this time because she'll say it again anyway. So what happens is we have mothers and fathers saying 1 time, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times. But you realize with every repetition, the volume goes up, the tone goes up. And before you know it, we're shouting and screaming and we're frustrated. And we're not tolerating frustration very well. So the child doesn't get a good image or role model of a parent who can tolerate frustration. So that doesn't go over very well. And then before you know it, you've got a whole load of negativity in the relationship. And I'm talking hundreds of repetitions because you don't realize there are 365 days in a year and lots and lots and lots of interaction. This kind of thing is going to keep going. So you say it once and then you follow up with action, and muscles understand touch, and the brain gets a very strong message from the touch and from the action.
So the once that you do give the instruction, is there a specific way to give that instruction the first time to optimize success or anyway?
Yeah, it has to be in command form. It should include the word please. It should include the child's first name. Sorry, please put away the Legos. Or you'd say, Suri, please put away 10 Legos because you already went to the gym that day and you're not going to hand over hand 8,000 pieces.
Right.
So think before you make the command and make sure it's something that you can hand over hand.
Oh, amazing. And I'm just reiterating, but the key is for the parent when you do hand in hand is to stay calm. So even if they go kicking and screaming, you just stay calm and just...
You stay calm and don't become contagious. Don't catch their mood. Remember, a lot of adults have to work on their own frustration tolerance. So usually what happens when parents take the course with me or come to sessions with me, by the third session, they usually say to me, Dr. Yaroslavis, this is not about the kids. This is all about me. I'm like, aha, you got it? So it goes.
I love that. Whenever I give a chinuch lecture, I always say that chinuch is about avoiding with ourselves more than anything.
100%.
So I totally get that. So when you feel that the hand-in-hand is you can't do that anymore, you go to nothing until. Describe that. What is that all about?
Okay. Nothing until looks like this. You have an older child already, a child that you're not going to touch and manipulate against their will, right? It's an older child, a child who understands language, who understands that they're not obeying you, who understands very clearly what you wanted or want. And you say, Suri, please clean up the Legos. And Suri is reading on the couch or she's doing something else. And she either says, no, I didn't play with them. It's not my job. Or she ignores you or she says later or whatever it is. Fine. You leave the Legos. You purposely pick something that's not time sensitive. You're not going to tell a child to go answer the phone in this drill or unpack the ice creams from the order. It's something that could wait. So you can stay calm. And you go about your business and do your thing. At some point, the child will come talk to you about anything. I need $5 for a carnival so tomorrow. I need this. I need that. And then you're allowed to say four words. The first three are scripted out for you. Nothing until the. And the last thing, you can fill in one word. And in this case, it's Lego. Nothing until the Lego. And you say it calmly and you say it with a smile. Most healthy, normally developing children will, with an attitude, probably put away the Lego. Some kids, every now and then, you'll get some. And usually that means that the parent launched into phase two too early. Okay, before frustration tolerance was absolutely accomplished. And some will say, I told you, it's not my job. I'm not doing it. We have examples like this in the book, that kind of thing. You just continue going about your business until they come again and you say nothing until the Lego. And you keep doing that. And eventually the Lego gets done. There's all types of alternatives within the program of what to do if the Lego never gets done. But I don't know if we have to go through this today. It's a little complicated, but exactly, I scripted out exactly what to do if the Lego doesn't get done. There's a way.
Well, okay, before we go to the third phase, let me just ask you, because you've said this a few times now, that this works for normally functional household, for normally developing children.
Mm-hmm.
That's not always the case. I mean, is it true that some children are just, you know, they have issues? They might have a personality disorder, I don't know, ADHD, whatever. There might be, I mean, there are children that are naturally more challenging. Are they not?
Right, so I use the term behaviorally challenged. Borderline is not an official diagnosis in the DSM-V until adulthood. So technically speaking, or even oppositional defiance disorder, these disorders that they give are, you know, designed to describe children who are behaviorally challenged. I don't like to use these diagnoses up until adulthood. So a child who has a harder time being macabre old, accepting authority, has a harder time. You're not going to tell me what to do. Nobody tells me what to do. I want to do what I want to do. Generally, those are the people who land up in my practice. And also, I don't want to be too rigid in defining a healthy household. In other words, life is not, you know, we don't live in a vacuum. People have parnasa issues, people, you know, livelihood issues, people have ailing parents, people have, I know this stuff happens. That doesn't make a house not normal. I just want to be clear. People have all kinds of things. Your house is still normal as long as you're not dealing in serious crisis mode. So the average child who's behaviorally challenged, running through my program, each phase takes a minimum of 6 weeks. 6 times 3 is 18 weeks. That's about a half a year. That's a child who's behaviorally challenged and has missed the boat boat number one of the terrible twos. It's not magic. If a child is 10 years old and doesn't know the meaning of the word no, and doesn't know the meaning of obeying you, and has been living on this planet for 10 years with erroneous messages of what this planet has to offer, I'm not a magician and neither are you. You're not going to fix 10 years in 10 days or even 10 weeks at that point. It might take 10 months, which if you look proportionately is not so bad, considering that it took 10 years to create the situation. So tantrums sometimes last very long on a very challenging child, a baseline beginning tantrums where a parent will not speak to a child until the tantrum passes, upwards of 2 hours. An 8-year-old, a 9-year-old. I just don't want people to think this is magic. It's hard work. I'll be very honest with you. And what I do is I hold hands, lots of hands, and I guide parents through it. We create WhatsApp chats. And parents send me frantically, you know, he's screaming for 45 minutes. I can't take it anymore. What should I do? And I'll hold them together and keep them calm because it's work. It's work.
Hard work, but important.
Very important. The results are amazing. It's just you have to be willing to put in some time and effort.
For sure, for sure. So before we go on, maybe at this time, I'll just take a couple of, I'll just read out a couple of questions here because they're relevant to what you just talked about.
Wonderful.
What was, I think you sort of addressed this, but what would be the technique of ignoring being unfazed apply? Would the technique of ignoring being unfazed apply to tantrums of kids who are a little older, like 4 to 6 years old, which I think you said it would be, right?
Of course. It applies to all tantrums, all the way until adulthood. Okay. Yep. Do you know what, can I give you a muscle of what this looks like?
Yes. Sure.
I don't know, in Australia, do you have meters, parking meters?
Sure.
People get parking tickets?
Yep.
Okay. In America, in New York, if someone's in a store and they run out and they find a cop writing a ticket on their car, right? And they come out and they get really frustrated and they start screaming at the meter maid. Did you ever watch their faces? They keep writing that ticket. This guy's screaming his head off. I just got it, which is adult tantrum, right? But they just stay completely calm and continue writing their ticket and walk their merry way. That's my visual. If that can help anybody.
Great analogy. The question is, which I was going to ask towards the end, but let me ask it now. What's the name of the book?
Oh, Are Your Hands Full?
Okay. So I'll put it up in the chat later. But
and there's volume one and volume two, you know, one for 0 to 10 and one for 10 to 18.
So the other question is about what you just said about that, the nothing until that you try and use something that's not time sensitive. So the question is, what if it is time sensitive? For example, let's say, what if the task is time sensitive, like getting dressed for school? I think this is an issue that a lot of parents experience. It's morning, you got to put them into the car by, I don't know, 8:20. Kids not dressed, please get dressed. We need to move, we need to go. And of course it is time sensitive.
Right, so you think it's time sensitive. In my world, time sensitive only means something you would have to call Hatzalah for. And chas v'shalom. And there, my whole program goes out the window because if safety is compromised, then there's no program. So to me, if it's dragging a child into a car or onto a school bus day after day after day after day so that they should go to school is a terrible waste of chinuch opportunity because that child is not learning to manage his own schedule. And you should live to be 120, all of you, but you're not going to be there past a certain age to yank him or her out of bed. And once they get married, you certainly can't yank him or her out of bed. So I'm not going to go heavily into my morning routine chapter, but I don't know if you read it, Rabbi Garari, but there's a very, very distinct way of handling mornings. And no, it's not time sensitive. The child misses the bus, stays home. And what ends up happening is that when a child sees that a parent is unfazed by the whole thing and doesn't carry the pressure and is bored all day and the parent doesn't care, so to speak, and doesn't get frustrated and flustered, they'll be on that bus the next day.
So I'm assuming if they stay home, it's stay home without any entertainment or
exercise. Correct. No screens and no, they can read, they can color. They can play, but they get their lunch served to them, but there's no strong interaction, no baking, no cooking, no fun activities, no shopping, no errands, obviously. It's just a day home. And most parents get frantic and say, you're punishing me, and I'll answer, This is not about you. This is about a child, putting a child in a situation with it to learn to take responsibility. Also, I find that parents don't give children enough time. This is just an added tidbit. My suggestion is an hour before departure, just like the airports, local airports, that is. If your child's bus is coming at 8 o'clock, you need to be up and at it by 7. Most parents are giving kids no more than 15, 20 minutes to get out. That's because people sleep longer than they should in the morning. I'm talking about adults. And that is probably, from all the years that I'm doing this, that's mostly responsible for the tension and the pressure. Not so much, because it's not physically fair to children to have them transition from a bed to a school bus in 20 minutes. I don't do that well in 20 minutes. I'm not out of my bed and into my car in 20 minutes.
Okay, sounds good. So then moving on to the third stage, which is impulse control.
Right.
Which I suppose, where I think of impulse control is something that, especially as Jews, the whole Torah mitzvah is based on impulse control. It's at least all the mitzvahs are necessary for you.
It's not
doing the things that we want to do a lot of the times, right? Which is a life skill, which not everyone has naturally, I suppose. So how do we move into that phase, and what is that phase, and what does it look like?
Okay, so just to follow up on your analogy, I often call the obedience phase the asay phase. Okay, there are 248 mitzvahs asays, to do mitzvahs in the Torah, and then the los asay phase, the impulse control, I would call follow up with the los asay phase, which is the things we're told not to do in the Torah. Obviously, we all have an easier time with the asays, with the obedience part. We do better with essays. We make ourselves crazy to clean for Pesach and make it this way. And we really follow through, and we're from, and we say mountains of Tehillim, and we do all that. But when it comes to a juicy piece of Lashon Hara that you're not supposed to repeat, not today, not tomorrow, not next week, not next month, not next year, not ever, we have a harder time. This is human nature. Same is with chinuch. Children it's easier to teach obedience than it is to teach impulse control. And you have a better propensity or a better chance of a child mastering impulse control if they're an obeyer by nature. If a child gets very used to obedience from age 4, 5, 6, 8, 12, 15, and then all of a sudden at 15, they're faced with a piece of technology that a friend shows them or something that they shouldn't be involved with, the fact that they're obedient by nature will stand in their good stead. Of course, you need to keep your Tehillim in the other hand, but we can't say that children will never be exposed to things that they want. So impulse control is a really hard thing to teach. I use a strategy called time and space, which is described in the book. It's called time out for the little kids and time and space for the big kids. And basically what that does is it helps kids control their impulses that are not dangerous. For example, if they yell and scream and fight like crazy with their siblings. So we do impulse control by sending them into timeout or time and space. And there's very specific parameters of how I do that. And they're described in the books. So that's what time and space is all about.
Can you give an example of like when you would use that?
Time and space is when it's a time out is when a young child does something negative that you've been ignoring for 12 weeks, 6 weeks of phase one, 6 weeks of phase two, and that negative behavior still exists. Throwing trucks down the stairs, really beating up another sibling, but really, because I don't like to get involved with sibling rivalry on a steady basis. Or, something that they're doing, and no matter how much you've ignored it, it just didn't die of neglect. So then we use timeout as an indicator. And then every time that behavior happens on a very consistent basis, they get timeout. And timeout is not the way the world defines timeout. It's not a number of minutes. It's very short. It's for 10 seconds. Child sits in a chair in a certain position. You count to 10 and it's over. And it goes easy. With the little kids, it goes very easy. I'm going to be honest with you. Most of my parents, when they master frustration tolerance and obedience, they never need time out. It's very, very, very interesting. Why? Because once a child is an obeyer, and you say to a little kid, I don't want to go into 72-hour mode, that's another strategy, but I might mention it later, you know, it's not okay for you to pull so-and-so's ponytail over and over and over again. Most children who are obeyers by nature will be able to follow that. So, you know, that's something that's important to pay attention to. Time and space for the teenagers is used during teenage explosions. But again, weeks have to have gone by where these were ignored. And then we make a conscious decision, okay, we're gonna launch into phase three.
What does that look like, time and space?
Time and space is different. Time and space is where you explain to the child beforehand, not while it's happening, that in order to control one's impulses, when we get so angry and we don't know what to do with the rage, most of us take time and space. That means we separate ourselves from the people who are upsetting us and we take a little time to cool down. And you explain that's a strategy that adults need to learn and that it's not a punishment. I'm not telling you to take time and space to punish you. I'm not doing anything like that. But what I'm doing now is I'm teaching you how to separate yourself from the situation that's causing you to become very agitated and very aggravated. And then what ends up happening is that they go into a room and they're free to come out as soon as they feel in control. And if they feel in control, then they can come out right away. And that's it. Wow. That's what time and space kind of looks like.
Can I ask all of
I'm sorry. All of this is very clearly delineated in the book, step by step by step by step, written out much, you know, I'm just giving you like an overview.
You just mentioned something in passing, and I just want to pick up on it. You said about hitting another sibling, it's got to be more significant or serious because you don't like to get involved in sibling rivalry. So can you just elaborate? A lot of parents often ask about, what do you do about sibling rivalry?
I know. So sibling rivalry is the most healthiest, most wonderful phenomenon in the world. And it's such a shame that everybody tries to get rid of it. And it makes me laugh because I don't know about you. I fought with my brothers and have any sisters, but I fought with my brothers. Did you? Don't tell me you didn't, because I know you did. Okay. And the reason you did, and the reason I did, and the reason every single person who's listening to this did, is because this is the way Hashem wants it. This is the way Hashem wants it. Now, why? Why did the Ribbono Shel Olam set it up this way? The reason the Ribbono Shel Olam set it up this way is that in the 7,000 days, the 20 years, somewhere along the way, children have to learn to tolerate other people. You have to learn to coexist. You have to learn to fargin. How do you say fargin in English?
It's a very hard word to translate. To give in and let other people enjoy or succeed or
right, and be happy for them.
Yeah, be happy for them.
Be happy for them that they're successful. You have to learn to coexist. You have to learn to forgive. You have to learn to tolerate. You have to learn to forgive. You have to learn. These are all components of relationships. So the Ribbono Shel Olam sets up a marriage preparation course. That's what I call it. So for 20 years, approximately, we practice on our siblings. Who would you like your children to learn these skills on? Where do you want them to learn these skills? Here, the Ribbono Shel Olam, Hashem sets up a perfect, beautiful laboratory in your house that your children could practice sharing rooms, sharing bathrooms, giving in that somebody else has a shower after them, before them, sharing toys, all of this, and you want to get rid of it. Where are they supposed to learn the skills from? Because we as adults don't have the frustration tolerance to tolerate the noise that it makes.
But how about if they're not learning a skill? How about if they're not giving in? Are we supposed to provide guidance?
So the problem is parents jump in too quickly. That's why they're not learning it. If you would just disappear emotionally and let them fight it out, I've had parents call hundreds of times reporting me this. They work it out. Okay, idiot, you can have it now. There you go. It's done. They work it out. It's noisy. It's volatile. It could get very intense. You have to keep it safe. By safe, I mean that, chas v'shalom, nobody should hurt each other. By the way, I've spoken to many Hatzalah guys. And I've asked many Hatzalah guys, tell me the truth. How many times did you have to transport a child to a hospital or medical facility for stitches or a broken bone or something like that for something that a sibling did to them? Please tell me no. Because there's a thermostat. Sibling relationships, it's a love-hate relationship. They know when to stop. Oh, you'll get two kids jumping on a bunk bed and one falls down and breaks an arm. That's not sibling rivalry. Okay, sibling rivalry is like when child A beats up child B to the point where they need serious medical attention. Doesn't happen that often, hardly. And usually there's dysfunction going on if that were to happen. But in a normally developing situation, children are supposed to fight. It's healthy for them to fight. Let me ask you a question, Rabbi Gerari. When do children not fight?
Some children fight quite a bit, don't they?
When do children not fight? When there's crisis. Then they don't fight.
Interesting.
Then they don't fight. I'll never forget this clip I saw. You all remember the crisis that we had in Jersey City, right? That terrible shooting we had. Unfortunately, everybody forgot about it because Corona hit right afterwards. But it was very close to home by us. We were not far away. And a lot of us heard what was going on in all of this. Anyway, the mayor of New York City, Mayor de Blasio at the time, he came to be Menachem Mogel. And it was all over the news. And you saw the following picture. You saw Mayor de Blasio sitting across from the father, and then an approximately 11-year-old, delightful-looking boy. And on his lap is a 4-year-old little girl, and she has her head on his shoulder, and he's stroking her back. I saw that picture and I just cried. 11-year-old children are not supposed to be stroking their 4-year-old sister's backs. They're supposed to be fighting like cats and dogs over Legos and dolls and who sits next to Tati and who sits next to Mommy. That's what's supposed to be. When you see a child taking kids, those children are not siblings anymore. They're parenting each other. So whenever children don't fight, that's when I start worrying. What's wrong? You hear stories in the war, in the Holocaust, about an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old that were sent across Europe with one coat between them. And the 10-year-old made the 8-year-old wear the coat the whole time. You hear these stories. We know these stories. That's when children don't fight. The Baruch Shalom should help, but they should always fight.
That's amazing. Before I ask one a couple of more questions, please, if anyone wants to ask any questions, please now's the time to put it in the chat and I'll read them out. So a lot of what you described, and hopefully people will take this further and either go on the website or buy the book or whatever, requires, as you said, a lot of effort on the parents' part. It's an avodah, it's a service of Hashem that parents have to engage in. And obviously sometimes with children close in age and busy households, two parents working and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of frustration, a lot of, you know, it's hard. So what would you, give, like just a bit of tips for parents? How do parents work on themselves? Just a few practical things maybe to lower their frustration, maybe to make things a little bit easier so that they can tolerate the tantrums, the screaming, the sibling rivalry or whatever the case is.
Okay, so I'm gonna reverse the question for you. Just from all the years of doing this, you know the Chazal that says, Adam nifal kafi pu'ulosav. A parent becomes a parent, a person becomes the product of their actions. So when you're asking me a question, how should somebody change internally? There is no way to access our internals except through action. So if I sit a parent down and I say to them, up until 2 hours, you can't respond to tantrum number one, no matter what. So they follow, not because their heart tells them to do that, but because I told them to do it. And they follow it from an action perspective. Okay. That changes a little bit of the inside. Then the second tantrum comes and they ignore again, and they ignore again, and then they ignore again. And then they usually come back 2 weeks later to the next session and they'll say to me, I don't know why, but I'm feeling calmer. Because the actions change you. You know, the entire Torah is based on that. We're an action-based religion, right? There are very few of our mitzvahs that involve, you know, via hafta, emotion, loving, and very few. Mostly we're action-based because the actions change us. The actions define us. So this program works the same way. By ignoring, you calm down. You're asking me, how can I calm down so that I can ignore? Doesn't work like that. I expect you to be tense and nervous in the beginning, but you ignore anyway, and you will find yourself disconnecting from the negativity and becoming calmer during negativity, so that you'll be able to spend so much more kayak and so much more energy on those positive moments. The reading of the stories and the playing of the games. We didn't talk much about this because it's a behavior management seminar, but playing board games and talking to them and having conversations with them and playing games on the road when you're driving, who can find this license plate and who can find that? All of that is the positive energy. But if you're so connected to the negative episodes, it's very hard to detach yourself and focus on the positive aspects of how cute your children are and how adorable they are and how wonderful they are and how they're the future of Klal Yisrael. If not for them, what would we have? So ignoring the negative kind of moves you over, and automatically you're going to become a more positive parent.
That's beautiful. In other words, the positive energy really is so much more important in a way, but we don't have space to do it if it's
negative. And my objection to all of these parenting programs who say to parents, be positive, you have to be positive. And then the poor parent tries so hard to be positive, can't master it. Her self-esteem or his self-esteem goes lower. I'm no good. And then before you know it, I'm just terrible at this. So really, that's not the nakuda. The point is, get rid of the negative. Your whole heart will open up. And that's why I focus on it this way.
Beautiful. Just a question that's coming here, one or two questions about, just going back to the sibling rivalry. I think that struck a chord of here a little bit. What if during a sibling fight, they talk rudely to one another? Don't we need to guide them to talk nicely?
Okay, so brothers and sisters have their own Shulchan Aruch. Okay, you know this, and so do I. Your average child will say who knows what to their brothers and sisters and wouldn't dream of saying this to their friends, neighbors, even cousins. Why not? Because they don't share parents with their friends, neighbors, and cousins, duh. They share parents with their siblings, and therefore they share the most precious thing they have. It's very hard. I give the mashal I give in the book is, I don't want to go into it because it's too lengthy, but I don't know if you read this, about a kolo couple, a beautiful kolo couple, and everything was perfect. And on the night of their fifth anniversary, he walks in with flowers and she made a gorgeous dinner. And he says to her, you put marriage on the map. Marriage is so wonderful. I decided marriage is so wonderful. So he opens up the door and he says, meet the next one. And he brings in the second wife. And then 2 years later, he brings in a third wife. And 3 years later, he brings in the fourth wife, which is basically what we do with these kids. Every 2 years or 3 years, we say, meet so-and-so. And we're all going to be one big happy family. We're all going to love each other. When he gets a red lollipop, she's going to get a red lollipop. When he gets a, right? And we expect these kids to just do that. I mean, what would we look like? This is a normal phenomenon that the Rabbanu Shalom set up. I mean, why didn't the Rabbanu Shalom set it up that every single mother gives birth once? He could have done that. He could have solved his population problems another way. The Rosh Hashanah could do anything. Why did he Dafka set it up this way? For this reason. So children will talk rudely to each other, and then they will be the best friends. You all know this after marriage, because after marriage, if I have my wife and I have my wife and I have my husband and I have my husband, then I don't need mommy and tati so much anymore, and not the same way. And therefore, I can scratch my head and say about my brother or sister, ooh, they're not so bad after all. So when you hear them saying rude things, just treat it like a negative behavior the same way it's any other behavior and ignore it. It will die. The reason it hasn't died yet is because you haven't ignored it yet. All negative behaviors grow like tomato plants if you give them attention. So if you've been saying, don't talk to him that way, don't talk to her that way, how many times did I have to tell you, blah, 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 then they're going to keep doing it.
Wow. Which I guess links into the next question, which says, what happened when siblings don't start fighting into adulthood? What went wrong there?
Okay, so two things. Number one, it's an indication, most of the time, that parents are too involved in their married children's lives. In other words, the idea is children fight about the attention they get from their parents. Supposedly, when you get married, that connection is supposed to get a little bit weaker. And you're supposed to focus your attention on your spouse and on the family that you build. And parents are supposed to be more in the background. This is the proof of the pudding is fascinating, is that usually what happens after marriage is that most married siblings get along beautifully until when? 50 years later, when parents get ill and need to be cared for, or Yerusha, bingo, it's about mommy and tati again. As long as it's about mommy and tati again, there's going to be the rivalry, because you're sharing something, you're jockeying for position, for emotional support from parents, which is a very precious phenomenon. As soon as the parents pull out, married children will usually get along very well. That's one phenomenon. And the other phenomenon is it depends very much on who everybody marries. So if people marry healthy and, you know, and everybody kind of gets along, then that should happen. Every now and then he'll have what we call a tsuga kumana, an in-law spouse that, you know, throws over the apple cart. But in general, that's not what's supposed to happen.
Question is, how do you deal with kids under two who repeatedly lash out at other babies?
Okay, that's a normal behavior, by the way. Biting, pulling hair. Two-year-olds have no impulse control. They're not supposed to. They're not supposed to. So the first thing is, don't panic. There's nothing wrong with your kid. That's A. Once you're not panicking, then already the sun comes out. Then it's not so bad. Separate without comment. We didn't talk about that strategy. Multiple times, separate, without yelling, without screaming, without saying, no, don't, because the more you say no, the more you're feeding the behavior. It will stop. They just don't have the control.
One last question here. You mentioned parents often intervene too quickly in sibling fighting. What about parents who don't intervene enough? What's the flip side? Or is there such a thing? I mean,
up until safety is compromised, there's no such a thing. If you really, really think that someone's going to land up, you know, chas v'shalom, really hurting the other one, then of course you intervene. But even when you intervene, you're only intervening to separate them. Your house is not a Beis Din. You're not a Dayan. You're not deciding who's right and who's wrong. You're just separating them so that it remains safe. Very big difference.
No, I get that. That's beautiful. So before we end, just I know people enjoyed this and then got a lot out of this, but if people want to take this further, I don't know if we can get your books here in Sydney, we have to find out, but I know you can get them off the web. So what's the name of the website?
Okay, so it's www.handsfulchinuch, handsfulchinuch.com. By the way, does Feldheim distribute anywhere?
Are your books Feldheim books?
Yeah.
I haven't seen the books in Sydney. I'll have to see, maybe they're in Melbourne. But I know that they are available to download from the web, and you can order them from the web. So and you can get to learn a lot more what Dr. Yaroslavits does from the website. I've gone on the website. It's beautiful. Handsful Chinuch, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this can go on forever, I suppose, but we're out of time at dinner. We're very, very respectful of people's time. So we try to start on time and end on time. So I want to really thank you so much for an amazing session.
Really, my pleasure.
Really value-based and Torah-based. And it's a real pleasure. And I know that you're in the middle of moving and making aliyah. So we want to wish you lots of hatzlacha. And the only reason I mentioned that is because a lot of people know that, because I had to explain to them why we didn't do the session last
week. I apologize. Okay, but we are going back and forth to the States. I'll still be seeing clients in the States. I'll still be doing stuff here. So it'll be back and forth in two places.
Who knows? Maybe one day I'll come to Australia, and if you do, we'll definitely host you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you everyone for coming. Thank you everyone for joining us. We had a beautiful crowd here tonight.
Baruch Hashem.
I got a lot out of it. I'm sure everyone else did as well. And I want to wish everyone lots of nachas from their kinderlach. And aslacha in the parenting. And aslacha to you. And really, thank you very, very much.
Okay, it was a pleasure seeing everybody. And I hope you all benefited from it. Thank you so much. All the best.
We'll be in touch.
Yes. Hatzlacha rabba.
Thank you, everyone. Okay, everyone, have a good evening. I'm going to sign off.